Okay. So I'm going to talk about the large N expansion for QCD, which was introduced by Itoft originally in 1974, and it's turned out to be an extremely useful tool to study the strong interactions, both qualitatively and quantitatively. And in this talk, I'm going to concentrate on the applications of 1 over N for the theory for which it was originally invented, which is QCD, and by that I mean the real thing, and show how well the results compare with the experimental data in the PDG. And there's lots of evidence by comparing with experiment that the expansion parameter is, in fact, 1 over N and not, say, 3 over N or 1 over 10N or whatever. It's about a third. And if you expand to sufficiently high order by combining 1 over N with other symmetries, you can get results to very high precision. Okay, so just to remind you, QCD is an SU3 gauge theory, and I will consider NF flavors of massive Dirac fermions in the fundamental, and there's no supersymmetry, so, anyway, talking about QCD and superpotentials at the same time is not acceptable. And one of the great features, an important feature actually of this theory is that there are no scalars in the fundamental and no fermions in the adjoint. It makes a huge difference to the observed spectroscopy and so on. And for light fermions, as you'll see, all we're going to be doing is symmetries. To get dynamic information is very difficult. And for light fermions, I'm going to combine 1 over n with chiral symmetry, which is expanding in powers of the quark mass, expanding about the limit of zero quark mass. And for heavy fermions, you can combine this with heavy quark expansions and powers of 1 over m. I won't discuss that here. And you can treat electromagnetic and weak interactions as perturbations, though you need 1 over n for the strong dynamics. And furthermore, I'm going to get, since the data is at three colors, I want results for n over for three colors. And so I'm not going to be discussing, in some sense, the n goes to infinity limit, but rather treat 1 over n as an expansion parameter and expand in a series in powers of 1 over n, and then look at what the results say for three colors. And you could compare this with an expansion in the fine structure constant in QED. So for example, if you're doing the magnetic moment of the electron, so alpha is the analogous to 1 over n, you could get the leading term, which is 1, and then alpha over 2 pi, et cetera. And you can think of 1 as the contribution in the limit that electromagnetism is turned off. So for some quantities, you can think about things this way. But for other quantities, for example, for the hydrogen atom, you don't have hydrogen in the limit that alpha is turned off. The binding energies of hydrogen start at order alpha squared, and in fact are given by treating the leading interaction as the Coulomb interaction, which starts at order alpha. And even though you can't ever turn alpha off, in the sense that hydrogen doesn't exist when alpha is zero, you can still do a perturbation series. That is to say, you can include the Coulomb term and get the alpha squared pieces, but then you can neglect the spin orbit and so on, other higher order terms, because they contribute first at order alpha to the fourth. And for baryons, it turns out everything interesting really starts at order 1 over n. Actually, in large N QCD, everything starts at 1 over n because the n goes to infinity limit is a free theory. Okay, so the parameters which we have are the quark masses and 1 over n. The Itoft coupling, which is g squared n, is you take the n goes to infinity limit, keeping some scale mu fixed and lambda at some scale fixed. And there's a non-zero beta function in the theory, and so the coupling runs. And so for hadron physics, or low-energy hadron physics, lambda is not really a parameter of the theory. You can replace the running coupling by a non-perturbative parameter, lambda QCD, which sets the scale of the strong interactions. But except for that overall scale, lambda plays no role. So really, we do not have lambda at all. So 1 over n is the only parameter. Okay. So the basic facts that I wanted to mention are that the way the large N limit is taken, so that keeping lambda QCD fixed, is that meson masses, such as the rho mass and so on, are order 1. And baryon masses, such as the proton mass, are order N color, because the proton, a baryon, is made up of order N color quarks. If you look at graphically in perturbation theory, the sort of diagrams which contribute, so as is well known, planar graphs dominate. And for example, closed fermion loops, so pair production leads to a 1 over n suppression. And in general, the order of a graph is given by 2 minus by the Euler character, it's 2 minus twice the number of handles minus the number of boundaries, or the number of closed fermion loops. Now you can follow the, because closed fermion loops are suppressed, if you were to look at a meson correlation function, an endpoint meson correlation function, so here there's a three-point function, the dominant diagrams are planar graphs where you have a single quark loop which runs all the way around, and then you put in arbitrary numbers of planar gluons in the middle. And if you look at this diagram, just look at the structure of the diagram, you can see that there's essentially what Veneziano pointed out, a UNF quark cross UNF anti-quark symmetry, which by 1 over NFX, that is pair creation, is broken down to UNF. And the reason for this is that if you think of this meson operator, it has some quark line coming in, or an anti-quark going out, and a quark on the other side. And whatever comes out of this vertex must go into the next vertex, etc. And you can sort of keep track of the quark lines as you go along the diagram. And each X can be labeled by an incoming label and an outgoing label. And transformations on the incoming label are like a UNF Q bar, and on the outgoing label are like the UNF Q. And because of the way these things are tied together, this implies that basically for an endpoint function, the meson mesons can be treated, or these X's can be treated as matrices, NF by NF matrices, and the amplitudes, which are expectation values like this, are single traces, just because of the structure of this is a trace of a product of matrices. And of course, this is well known from matrix models and so on. But the general structure of correlation functions is single traces, and double trace operators are suppressed by 1 over N, and every time you have an extra trace, you get a 1 over N suppression. Furthermore, because of the UNF cross UNF symmetry, the meson is an NF squared matrix. And if you break it down to the diagonal UNF group, including 1 over N corrections, the NF squared matrix contains both an adjoint and a singlet. And at large N, the two parts of this matrix are related to each other. So the phi and the omega, or whatever, the eta prime and the eta, are related at large N, but then there's breaking at 1 over N. OK, so I'm going to concentrate mainly on baryons, but the question is whether you can say anything more for mesons than just the simple fact that I told you. So for example, you can follow quark labels. And you, in some sense, you get something like the quark model, because if you have a graph like this, where there's a quark and an anti-quark, and you just follow this thing, in large N, loops, the second diagram is suppressed. You only have diagrams like this. You can cut it in the middle, and it looks like quark-anti-quark pair production. So in the meson, you can have pair production. It doesn't just look like a non-relativistic quark model of a, you know, a quark and an anti-quark bound by springs or whatever you like. But nevertheless, you sort of have two handles you can tweak, the flavor and whatever labels of the quark and the flavor and labels of the anti-quark. So you can effectively write down a wave function. And the question is, can you do more with this? And OK, so I don't know the answer to this. This is one thing where if you could make some progress, it would be helpful. The other question which has come up is whether chiral SU3 cross SU3. So what I talked about before was U3 quark cross U3 anti-quark. But in the limit that the quarks are massless, you also have a chiral symmetry, which is U3 on left-handed fermions cross a U3 on the, or an SU3 on the right-handed fermions. And the question is whether this symmetry is in fact unbroken or linearly realized in some way for high-mass excitations, and in particular in the large N limit. This is clearly broken for the pions, so you have Goldstone bosons, but there's some evidence that as you go higher up in the mass spectrum, you get parity doubling. And so various people have worked on this. And again, this is, it looks like something along these lines could be true. And as I said, I don't know the answer to this, but it's one direction worth thinking about. Now let me just briefly discuss n-counting rules for mesons, and then I'll go on to the baryons. So because of the fact that endpoint meson functions are the single quark loop, and by counting, it's basically of order n color, because there are n color fermions which can run around the loop, you conclude that the operator which produces physical mesons with unit probability is psi bar psi divided by the square root of n, because you want a two-point function to have order one amplitude. So the two factors of root n from two of these cancel the n from the loop. And then if you go on to higher point functions, every time you introduce an x for a physical meson, you're increasing the operator psi bar psi, but with this wave function, this renormalization factor, whatever, the z factor of root n. And so every time you add a meson, you get a 1 over root n suppression. And so 3 meson interactions are 1 over root n, 4 meson interactions are 1 over n, and so on. And if you sort of take away a meson and look at the pion decay constant, which is like a 1 meson amplitude, that the pion decay constant is proportional to the square root of n. So what has been done is we have turned a strongly coupled theory of quarks and gluons in the large n limit into a weakly coupled theory of mesons with an effective coupling constant of 1 over root n. And this is consistent with the semi-classical expansion, if you look at where the powers of h bar go, that you really have a semi-classical expansion in powers of h bar over n. And this is easily seen. So for example, if you have a one-loop meson diagram, because each 3 meson amplitude is 1 over root n, the one-loop graphs are a 1 over n correction to the meson propagator. And it's one loop, so it's order h bar. And so you always get these h bar over n factors. OK, so now I want to compare. So all we really know is that single traces are more important than double traces. So now let me compare with experimental data. So the things we know are the low energy chiral Lagrangians, which is an expansion in derivatives. So it works for low momentum where this gradient expansion is valid. And the leading order term, the only possible terms at 2 derivatives, or first order in the quark mass, because the equation of motion tells you p squared is of order the meson mass squared, and the meson mass squared is linear in the quark masses, which is what this is. So with that counting, these 2 terms are leading order, has the pion decay constant as a parameter. But the interesting thing comes in at next order, which is order p to the fourth, where there are a whole bunch of terms here with coefficients, which are called L1 through L8. And all you really need to know is that some of these terms have a single trace and some of these terms have a double trace. And by looking at pion-pion scattering and so on, you can compare with, you fit to the data and see what you get. And it turns out that some of these constants are order 1 and some of these constants are order n. And okay, so either you can find this convincing or suggestive or whatever, but I think it's pretty clear from this that the order n terms are bigger than the order 1 terms. We're in the unfortunate position that the expansion parameter is only a third, and so it's, you know, nobody can do the experiment of setting n to 100, but it's pretty clear. I mean, the big terms are clearly the order n terms, and the small terms are clearly the order 1 terms. Now, even though this may not be that great an agreement, remember that the standard chiral perturbation theory expansion is an expansion in the mass of the strange quark, or an mk squared over some high scale, and the expansion parameter for the standard chiral expansion is also a third. And nevertheless, that's a very successful enterprise and has made good predictions. And part of the reason, of course, is that, you know, we're desperate in the strong interactions. If you can get things to 30% or 10% by going to second order, that's great. So what's done in chiral perturbation theory and where this is useful is that... Oh, so this is a little bit tricky. Okay, you asked that. So what happens here, what's done in this chiral Lagrangian is because we're doing SU3, there's an identity which allows... what is this thing called, though? I forgot. The statement that a matrix satisfies its own eigenvalue equation. The Kelly-Hamilton theorem allows you to reduce some operators in here to others. And that identity actually combines single trace and double trace terms. If you go back to the original form of the Lagrangian before using the Kelly-Hamilton theorem, you'll see that it's really this combination, which is order 1. That's where that comes from. OK. So the way this is used in practice is that because the SU3 expansion is also in about a third, what people do is that they treat 1 over n also as an expansion parameter. And so if you're working to some order, say to p to the fourth, you can keep only the leading terms. That is to say, if you're working to p to the fourth, you can keep only L2 through L10 and drop these first ones, because including the effects of these first few terms is the same as order p to the sixth terms, which I've already dropped. So it reduces 10 parameters down to 6 or something, which helps. The other interesting thing is that you can show in the large n limit that the theta dependence, I won't have time to go into this, is purely quadratic, and in fact that you can relate the theta dependence of amplitudes to the properties of the eta prime, and formally at least the eta prime mass squared goes like 1 over n. But here's an example where 1 over n corrections are quite large, because the experimentally the eta prime mass is 958 MeV. It's not really a very good Goldstone boson. And there are other examples that instanton effects essentially are quite large. And okay, as you'll see, things are going to be messy because we're going to be dealing with the real world, and you can't tweak parameters. You just take what you get. Now, I'll mention one spectacular failure just to show you that not everything is so nice, which is the famous delta I equals a half rule, which is like one of the most important facts about hadronic decays, which is that the lifetime of the K0 is about, the width of the K0 is about 400 times that of the K+. And if you look, this comes from a weak decay with a W exchange. And if you look at the diagram, so you look at a three-point amplitude with a kaon and two pions, you get graphs like this, which have two closed loops and are order n squared, whereas a single quark loop like this with a W exchange internally is one order and n down. So in the large n limit, you would say the first diagram dominates over all these other diagrams. Now, a W particle is charged. So if you have a charged particle going across here, the K+ has to have a charge. Otherwise, electromagnetic charge wouldn't be conserved. So one way of saying stating the large is that in the large n limit, K0 to pi naught should vanish, or that it should be 1 over n suppressed relative to, say, K+ to pi+pi0. And what's known is that experimentally this rate is about 400 times that of K+ to pi naught. Now, here's an example where just doing naive 1 over n is not maybe, I mean, you have to be careful. And the reason is there are other scales in the problem. This W exchange is really an effective four-quark operator induced at the weak scale. And renormalization group evolution shows that the K0 to pi naught amplitude has an anomalous dimension which gets enhanced as you scale down by some factor of log of MW over lambda, whereas the K+ to pi+pi0 amplitude gets suppressed as you scale down. And because our suppression factor is only 1 over n, or about a third, you can get, you know, these enhancement factors can compensate for 1 over n. So you have to be a little bit careful about what you're doing. So as I said, you're not taking n to infinity. You really have to deal with the fact that it's 1 over n and n's a third, and you're neglecting 1 over n squared pieces and so on. So Bardeen and company have worked on this. Okay, so what I wanted to concentrate on was baryons, because there's some interesting results there, again, with some symmetries where there might be some contact with the rest of what other people are doing at this conference. So the baryon is an epsilon symbol with NC quarks. That's the color singlet state. And because the quarks are fermions, and so they have the anti-commute, and this epsilon symbol is completely anti-symmetric, essentially, if you forget about the color labels, just remember that in the baryon you have one quark of each color, then as far as the other labels are concerned, which are the spin and flavor labels, the baryon is a completely symmetric state of the quark. So essentially, you can throw away the color and treat the quarks in a baryon as though they are bosons. So for three colors, for QCD, the baryons are three quark states. And in the quark model anyway, if you just look at non-relativistic quarks, the baryons are I'm going to look at the light quarks, so the UD and S quarks, and so the baryons form the quarks are a triplet under the fundamental representation of under flavor SU3. And they're a doublet under spin, that's just to say that they have spin 1/2. And the standard non-relativistic SU6 of the quark model treats these six states as one object, the six-dimensional representation of SU6. And it breaks up, of course, into the 3, 2 under the flavor cross spin. So that's the decomposition. And then baryons, because the quarks act like bosons, are the completely symmetric state of three of these, and which is the 56. And if you break that up into flavor and spin, that breaks up into the usual spin 1/2 octet and the spin 3/2 decouplet. And an important fact is the Coleman-Mandula theorem, which says that there's no way that the SU6 could be a symmetry in the relativistic theory, because you can't combine internal with space-time symmetries. Nevertheless, we'll show that there's some variant of this which is, in fact, an exact symmetry, and you can evade. Like all of Coleman's theorems, there's a way to evade them. Okay. So, well, the other example of evading the Coleman-Mandula theorem is supersymmetry, of course, which is, okay. So these are just the states. I'm going to be talking about these states. So here are the weight diagrams. Leonardo talked about the 10 bar, so this is the regular decouplet. So the delta, sigma stars, C stars, and omegas, and then these are the octet variants. So I'm going to just first give you some results from applying 1 over n to baryons. And everything is based on the fact that there's an exact symmetry for baryons as n color goes to infinity. And this is an SU6 symmetry. And it's not quite the non-relativistic SU6. There's a little subscript C here, which stands for contracted. So there's a, and I'll mention what that is later. There's a contracted SU6 flavor symmetry that connects these six states together. And the baryons form an irreducible representation of this algebra. And because you're combining flavor with spin, it relates the octet and the decuplet baryons to each other. Furthermore, the reason this is useful is, as I said, you want to go work at three colors, and you can compute the 1 over n corrections to whatever accuracy order you want in a systematic expansion. So we know not just the limit, but what the structure of the symmetry breaking is. So we can work to arbitrary order in the symmetry breaking and work out what the results are. And I want to show you, compare the results, the predictions, with the experimental results. And this actually, the results provide a deeper understanding of why the quark model and the Sker model work so well. And this will be connected with Rastelli's talk. Because I'll show you that there are some results in the quark model or the Sker model which can be proved, which are identical in structure to results which I'm going to prove in QCD to some order in 1 over n, just using symmetries. And in fact, those are the results which these models, which work well in these models. And other results in the models which don't follow from this symmetry don't, well, if you put enough parameters, you can get them to work. But just if you just, you know, do a straightforward calculation, they don't work so well. And so this contracted SU6 is sort of an underlying symmetry that relates the quark models, the various kinds of quark models, to each other and to QCD. Furthermore, there are new predictions for heavy baryon properties, and these predictions were made before the measurements. For the normal baryons, of course, the data has been there for a very long time, so you can, it's more like a check that the expansion worked. But here there were real predictions in the sense that the results were predicted and then the measurements came later. And there's been a lot of interesting work recently by a number of people on excited baryons, and I'm not going to discuss that here. I'll just stick with the ground state baryons. So let me give you some examples of the predictions, and then I'll tell you how you get them. So for example, if you look at the axial vector current matrix elements, or equivalently the pion couplings, in the octet and decuplet sector, there are four invariants. The NN pi coupling, this is two adjoints coupled to an adjoint, so there's an F and a D type coupling. And then the octet to the decuplet, there's one invariant, and then between the decuplets, there's one invariant. So there are four couplings. And so there are four numbers. And this contracted SU6 symmetry allows you to predict three ratios. So it can't predict the absolute scale, but it can predict the ratios. And the ratios are predicted to 1 over n squared accuracy, and if you want to 10% if you take the naive, 1 over n is a third. And here are the values, the predictions. So these are parameter-free predictions. These are just Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. And the numbers in parentheses, I haven't put error bars on here, but these are the experimental values for these parameters. So it certainly works for these numbers quite well, certainly to the 10% accuracy that you would expect. Okay. The case where the sort of the more detailed comparisons have been done is with the masses of the baryons. And let me first remind you about the famous Gell-Mann-Okubo relation. So the way you get the baryon masses in the standard SU3 analysis is you start at leading order, set the strange quark mass to zero, and all the octet baryons have some common mass. All the decuplet baryons have another common mass, M10. And then you turn on MS as a perturbation, work out what the invariants are. You find some terms with A and B, the two invariants here, one invariant there. And then you take linear combinations to get rid of all the parameters. And these are the famous Gell-Mann-Okubo relations. So there's the first one with the experimental number values, and here's the second. So these are the octet ones, and then these are the decuplet ones. And they work rather well. And in fact, Gell-Mann predicted what the mass of the omega minus should have been in a, before it was measured. And this, as I said, this is an expansion in powers of MS. And so the neglected terms, so the terms over here, which is that the equality is violated at order MS squared. And actually, one of the puzzles has been why these relations work so well. Because if you neglect terms of order MS squared, the MS expansion is typically an expansion, again, with a parameter of about a 0.3. And so MS squared terms are expected to be around 90 MeV, just by dimensional, you know, estimate, by a squiggly order of magnitude estimate, how big they are. And these relations clearly work much better than at the level you would expect just from this SU3 analysis. And what was shown was that if you combine SU3 with 1 over n, rather than talk about those three relations which I discussed before, it's better to take three different linear combinations of those relations. And it turns out, if you include the n factors, that one of these relations is order ms squared over n squared, a second linear combination is ms squared over n cubed, and this third linear combination is ms cubed over n cubed. And you can see why, first of all, they work much better than naively expected. You, in fact, get these factors of n squared, which make them work 10 times better than you would naively expect. But you can also see that there was some systematics in these, you know, how well the various relations work, which is better brought out when you take these particular linear combinations. And if you compare us in fractional accuracy, I did fractional accuracy just because, you know, whether you multiply this by 10 or how you scale it is, you know, it's arbitrary. So you just take the fractional values. Let me not discuss how I define this, but it's invariant under rescaling. And you can clearly see in here that, you know, here's this, the hierarchy of the which you get from this 1 over n expansion is clearly preserved. And these relations, because they're large n relations and follow from spin flavor symmetry, mix up the decouplet and the octet with each other. And you can clearly see that, you know, it's mixed up the octet and decouplet Gell-Mann-Kubler relations. Now, you can actually do a much more systematic analysis of all the baryon masses, including both 1 over n and SU3. So I just discussed the Gell-Mann-Kubler there, but you could do the whole thing starting from scratch. And you get a hierarchy of mass relations to different orders in 1 over n and ms. And you can compare with how well they work with the experimental data. And it's best to see this graphically. So if I just take those relations, I should mention one thing. There's zero parameters in what I'm talking about. All of these things are just Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Okay, so there's no parameter fitting. So there's one relation which works at order 1 over n squared, three relations at first order in the strange quark mass, two relations at order ms squared, and one relation at order ms cubed. If you were just doing SU3 analysis, that is to say expanding in ms, you would not ever get this first relation because there's, you know, it's violated at order 1. You would say that these three relations were comparable. They're all order ms, and these two are order ms squared, etc. These three things are just the three Gell-Mann-Kubler relations I talked about. And you can clearly see from here that the 1 over n's in the data, okay? Because here's the ms over n, n squared, n cubed, etc. It's rather evident. And you can also see from the equality of these two points, or, well, they're close enough, that 1 over n is comparable in size to the ms, the SU3 breaking. So 1 over n is just as useful in expansion as the standard SU3 analysis. And if you fit to this, you'll find that n color is 3. Okay. You can also look at the isospin splittings and so on, and they work well. Let me just point out just one fact, which is that there's a famous relation, the Coleman-Glashow relation. And it was shown using large N that this relation should actually work 10 times better than you might have naively have thought, because there are various factors of 1 over N on the right-hand side. And this was confirmed so this is an example where this was confirmed after the predictions. And the reason this was not known earlier was the C0 mass was not known accurately enough until 2000, when NA48 measured this thing. So you can get various baryon mass relations to fractions of an MeV. Similarly, you can get predictions for heavy baryons. And for example, an example of this is that the hyperfine splittings in the... There's a minus lambda Q here. So this is wrong, but never mind. You can relate hyperfine splittings in the heavy baryons to those in the light baryons. And an example of a prediction was that the Xi prime mass, one of the charm baryons, was predicted with this sort of analysis, with the usual, you know, MS is order 1/3 estimate of the error, to be this value, 2580 plus or minus 2 MeV. And it was then measured later, a few years later, to be 2576. So it works very well. And other predictions, other techniques at around the same time, so before the measurements, various quark models and so on, had predictions which were off by 25 MeV or more. There are also predictions for all the other charm baryon masses and the bottom baryon masses, but they haven't been measured yet. That's because they're not made at the B factories. You have to wait till Fermilab gets some more luminosity before... Celex has... Yeah, well, this is a... I think this is Celex, actually.
Oh, that's the double C?
No, this is the single charm.
But they
double charm. Double charm, yeah. But here for the charm baryons, I mean the single charm, but the sigma charm and the omega C and so on, and they don't...
You can do the double charm.
We haven't done it, but you can certainly do it. Okay, then I'm just going to go quickly through the results. You get a whole bunch of relations for the baryon magnetic moments the same way. I'll show this graphically. I just want to point out there's a lot of relations, and here we can't test many of these because the data isn't good enough to check whether this works or not. I mean, the measurements aren't accurate. So these are the results. Let me not go over this. And here again, I've shown you the ones for which there are experimental results, and there's a bunch of relations which work to 1 over n and 1 over n squared, SU3 breaking over n. And these are 1 over n relations. And again, you can see that the 1 over n squared work better than the 1 over n. There's one exception, so not everything is perfect. The delta to n gamma transition turns out to have it's a 1 over n squared result, but it works only to 30%. But when you have an expansion parameter of a third, once in a while the coefficient's 2. It's just life. However, in the case of delta to n gamma, there are two helicity amplitudes, and the ratio of those, I didn't give them value, but this works to within the 10% accuracy for 1 over n squared prediction. Now, another interesting fact, which is a result due to Mattis and Broughton called the I equals J rule, which is if you take two baryons or two skirmions going along and you exchange pions in the T channel, the size of that interaction is in large n is of order n to the 1 minus I minus j over 2. That is to say, the dominant interaction in the T channel is the exchange of mesons where I is equal to j. And what this means is that if you exchange in the T channel a rho meson, which is isospin 1, its dominant coupling to baryons should be spin 1 or look like a magnetic moment type interaction. And if you exchange an omega meson, which has isospin 0, its dominant coupling should be like a charge, or F1. And again, this is seen in the data that this holds. Okay. Finally, for excited baryons, I want to mention one fact, which is that in the quark model, the excited baryons form a 70 representation of SU6. And if you look at the splittings among the baryons, there's always been a problem with the mass of the lambda 1405. It's very hard to get the spin-spin splittings within different elements of the 70 to work out and also get the lambda 1405 mass right, because the lambda 1405 is sort of split a large amount from the other multiplets. In large n, the symmetry is SU6 contracted, which is, I'll discuss what that is later. And it turns out that the 70 breaks up into different irreducible representations under the contracted SU6. And you can show in large n that the spin-spin splittings within the various n star states is order 1 over n, but the splitting between them and the lambda 1405 is in fact order 1. So this also resolves a long-standing puzzle in this sector, and there's a bunch of people who have worked on this. Okay, so at the end, I wanted to explain where the symmetry comes from, because one of the things which you might be able to do with the string theory methods is to get, I don't think you're going to be able to calculate these coefficients to 2 digits, but certainly if there's a symmetry there, that's something which should hold and should be robust to various deformations and so on. So I want to discuss where the symmetry comes from. And so I'm going to use the basic n-counting rules for baryons, which were derived by Witten, based on the fact that the baryon is made up of nc quarks. So the baryon mass is order nc, its size is order 1, baryon meson couplings are order root n, and every extra meson you add, just as in the usual meson sector, produces a 1 over root n suppression. If you look at one-body matrix elements, so Q bar Q operator matrix element in the baryon, its matrix element is essentially order n, because that operator could be inserted on any one of the nc quarks. If you look at a two-quark operator, its matrix element is order nc squared, because the two parts of this could be inserted in independent ways on the two-quark lines and so on. And I've put inequalities here because what's going to be important is various cancellations. So this is the largest it could be, but if everything canceled out, it could be 0 or whatever. It could be smaller than this. Okay, so the example of a baryon-meson coupling being order root n is that if you take a meson operator, you can insert it on any one of these n quark lines, so that's just a combinatorial factor of n, and then you add to it the result that I told you earlier, that every meson operator is a q bar q operator divided by root n, so this is just the z factor if you want, and you multiply these together, and this is how you show that the amplitude's order root n. Now, a non-trivial and interesting result is that meson baryon scattering is order 1. And that comes about because if you think about a graph like this, where there's an incoming meson and an outgoing meson, these two things could have been inserted on the quark lines in n possible ways, and then you get 1 over root n from each of these, and that's an order 1 amplitude. But if you insert them on different quark lines like this, then of course the combinatorial factor becomes n squared. And so you might think that the meson baryon amplitude is in fact order n. But the problem is that if you think about this, there's a baryon coming in, this meson inserts some energy onto this quark line, and the quark is in an excited state. And to get back to the ground state baryon, you have to de-excite the quark. You need to exchange a gluon to the other line where the energy now comes out in this meson. And this extra gluon costs you a factor of 1 over n. And so again, this graph is order 1. OK, so what I'm going to derive just comes from the statement that baryon meson scattering is order 1. And I'm going to do this for pion baryon scattering, but it really holds for any meson. So the facts I'm going to use are that the baryon mass is order n. And so when the n goes to infinity limit, it's essentially a heavy, it's at rest. It's a static source. And the baryon propagator is just what you get in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, 1 over the energy denominator. And the other fact I need is that the baryon meson vertex is order square root of n. And in chiral perturbation theory, the way the pion couples is a gradient of the pion divided by f pi times the matrix elements of the axial current. So the f pi is of root n, and these matrix elements of the axial current are order n. So that's how the net root n in the amplitude comes about. And I want to take the matrix elements of the axial vector current between baryon states. And so what I'm calling A mu B prime B is not it's not an operator anymore. It's matrix elements in baryon. So these are just a bunch of numbers labeled by the initial and final baryon and the quantum numbers of the meson it's coupled to. So that in the n goes to infinity limit, the pion coupling is essentially the gradient of the pion divided by f pi times this matrix of numbers. And the time component, the zero component doesn't contribute because you can show that the matrix element here with an A0 on the axial current is there's just no invariant you can write down in the limit that the baryon is static. It has to have some recoil. So it's just space derivatives like this. And because the axial vector matrix element is order n, I'll factor that n out and write it as n times a matrix x of numbers. So the matrix labels are suppressed now, the B prime and B. And so x is order 1. And now you just look at meson baryon scattering. And the reason for pions is I can expand in energy. I can use chiral perturbation theory. So at low momentum, the only two diagrams are these. There's a direct diagram, which has x for the initial meson times x for the final meson, with 1 over e as the energy denominator. And then I have the cross diagram with the x's in the opposite order. And it's a commutator, because in the second case, the energy denominator is minus 1 over e. And those factors of n I told you about before, there's two factors of n from these two A matrices and two factors of root n from the two f pi. So overall, there's just a factor of n. And so this scattering amplitude is n color times this commutator. And it has to be unitary in the large n limit. And so there's no way that you can have this, and the commutator times nc must be order 1 or smaller. It cannot grow with n. And so if you take this object x and write it as an expansion in powers of 1 over n, the leading term, the n goes to infinity limit of x, must commute. OK? This is it. This is the argument. So in the large n limit, two x's have to commute. So this essentially is what leads to the spin flavor symmetry. Let me just go on here. So the algebra, the contracted SU6 symmetry that I have, is essentially these commutation relations. That, you know, these are the standard ones that spin with spin is JJ is the structure constant, J isospin is the structure constant times I. This is the statement that the axial current has spin 1 and isospin 1. And the interesting extra relation is as x commuted with x is 0. And this whole thing is is the SU6 contracted algebra. And so the starting point is to work out the irreducible representations of this algebra. And then you work out what the structure of the broken symmetry is. And you can either use this, you can use the standard theory of induced representations for these algebras and work out infinite dimensional unitary representations. But one solution to this is, in fact, the Skirm model. So in the Skirm model, the baryon is a soliton of some collective coordinate excitation. And these flavor generators, which are these axial currents, are the traces of these collective coordinates. And if you look at the commutator of two of these x's, it just commutes because this is a coordinate and coordinates commute. So the Skern model realizes the spin flavor algebra exactly because of through this. If you take the quark model, the standard non-relativistic quark model has SU6 generators. So just think of these as simple non-relativistic quarks with a, I have 10 transparencies, so. With QQ daggers one, and these are the spin isospin, and these are what are called the spin flavor generators, which both have a spin and a flavor matrix in the middle. So this generates the SU6 algebra. And the standard SU6 commutation relations are given here. And now, in the large N limit, the axial current matrix elements are order N. And so if I define something which is finite as N goes to infinity, which is I define X as G over N, and just take the limit of this algebra. So taking a limit of the algebra is doing a contraction. The first two relations stay the same, but this one, the right-hand side, vanishes. And it gives you back the contracted SU6 algebra. So both the large N quark model and the Skern model have this SU6 algebra. And you get, because it's a contracted Lie algebra, you get the irreducible representations are an infinite dimensional, you get an infinite tower of degenerate states. And it's been known for a long time that the quark and Skern models, in fact, at large N, give the same results in terms of group theory. And what we have seen is that the reason is that, in fact, that is the group theory of large N QCD. Now, you can work out the structure of 1 over N corrections. I'm not going to discuss that, but if you consider extra pions, you know that every time you add a pion, you should get a 1 over root N suppression. But because the pion vertex is order root N, naively, you get a root N enhancement. And what that tells you is that these amplitudes, which are multiple commutators, should vanish to higher and higher order in 1 over N. So this should go like 1 over root N. Naively, it goes like N to the 3 halves. So these things should be 1 over N squared, and so on. And one interesting thing we found in doing this is that Feynman diagrams like this end up producing multiple commutators, which is an interesting structure. So you can take these relations that these things should vanish to some order in 1 over N, and you can solve them. And the solution in the SU2 case turns out to be, so in this case, what comes in are these x's, but now I need the x's to expand it to 1 over N. And also the mass splittings come in because the baryons get degenerated or break the degeneracy at 1 over N. So from the propagators, you get the mass splittings. And when you work out what the consistency conditions are, you find that at the 1 over N pion couplings, so in the expansion of X, the matrix X1 is proportional to X0. So essentially, you just renormalize X0. And another interesting fact is that the masses, the leading 1 over N term in the mass, has to go like J squared. There's no other possibility you can have. So the mass relations I talked about before come from results like this, that the first term in 1 over N in the mass should go like J squared. The 1 over N cubed term should go like J fourth, etc. And in the Skern model, of course, you know that this is the form of the mass splittings. So if you take ratios of pion couplings, because these first two terms are equal, the ratios of pion couplings should first have corrections at order 1 over N squared. And it was this result which gave those G pi and N values I gave you before. And this explains why the Skern and quark model work so well. If you look at the old Atkins, Nappi, Witten paper and look at their values for G pi and N and G pi and delta, the actual values are a total disaster. However, the ratios work extremely well. And the reason is the absolute value depends on the details of the Skern model, but it turns out the ratio is, in fact, just following. So the Skern model, because it has a representation of the SU6 algebra, it gives you the same result that you would just get from large N QCD. So it's not an accident that these ratios work. I mean, the fact that it's exactly on is an accident, but I mean, I gave you the other values, the pi, delta, delta, et cetera. They're not exactly on. Okay, so the general solution of these consistency conditions is that any quantity can be expanded as a power series in G over N, J over N, and T over N. And you can think of these as one-body operators acting on a quark line. And if you think about what happens, every time you have if you have a two-body operator, for example, you need a connected graph which connects two quarks together, and you need a one-gluon exchange. And every time you add a gluon, because the gluon couplings are 1 over N, you get a 1 over N suppression. So every time another quark takes part in the interaction, you get a 1 over N suppression, and that's essentially what the previous result says. In the Skern model, the same results follow because this 1 over N expansion here, J over N and T over N are canonical momentum, and you know that the time derivative expansion tells you that every time you have a factor for time derivative, you get a 1 over n factor, and that's where these two come in. And the g over n is what was called x in the Sker model and is order 1. So this is, in fact, identical to the time derivative expansion in the Sker model. And I should say the structure is different from the old SU6, but I won't get into that. Another interesting fact comes about in chiral perturbation theory. So for example, if you were doing loop corrections, you know from the general arguments that a semi-classical expansion in H bar is connected with the 1 over n expansion, so you would expect that loop graphs like this should be order H bar over n. However, because pion-baryon couplings are order root n, naively this radiative correction gives you an order n correction. But again, if you look at the renormalization here, it turns out these diagrams also produce multiple commutators. This is the statement that these Feynman graphs look like multiple commutators. And in fact, this double commutator was precisely the thing which was shown to be 1 over n squared based on these Pion-Meson arguments. And so n times 1 over n squared converts an expansion in powers of n into, in fact, an expansion in inverse powers of n. So you get back consistent results connected with, as you would expect from the semi-classical expansion in powers of 1 over n. And you can see this, I mean, you can do much more detailed things comparing the Axel currents with the data, but I'm not going to discuss that here. Okay, so just to summarize, the main progress really has been made using symmetries, and these are not symmetries of QCD in the sense of the full theory of QCD. They're symmetries of certain parts of QCD. So for example, what I haven't talked about, a very successful program has been to apply heavy quark symmetry to heavy mesons. Here, we applied contracted SU6, which is a symmetry for baryons, but not for all of QCD. The Veneziana showed there was this is U3 cross U3 symmetry for mesons. And we've seen, I mean, just comparing with experiment, I hope I convinced you that expanding in 1 over n works as well as the standard methods of expanding in powers of the strange quark mass. Now, one thing which has always bothered me is you need to understand better how the Sker model and the quark model emerge. One thing you could, or how they're related. One thing you could say is, well, it's just an accident that the Sker model works. It happens to have the same symmetry as QCD. But I think, anyway, this is just a hunch that there's more going on than that. It seems like an amazing coincidence that that would happen. But nobody has been able to construct any direct mapping, and even in a toy model, really, between the quark and the soliton pictures. And again, this is something like string theory, if you could make some progress here, this might hold in QCD, because again, this is a qualitative thing. You're not looking for detailed quantitative predictions. I should mention, in the general case, Kermion quantum numbers are not the same as what you would get in a quark model, but for fundamentals of SUN, this is true. I also mentioned there was this additional information in mesons beyond Veneziano symmetry, but again, in this case, you have to pin it down. So yesterday's talks on these integrable systems suggested, again, something similar to parity doubling and an chiral SU3 cross SU3 symmetry. And what you need to do is to sort of make precise in what limit the symmetry is exact. And clearly, since n is not large, to compare, you want to figure out at least what the leading symmetry breaking term looks like, what the tensor structure or the quantum numbers of that operator are. And I think this is it. So. Okay, so let me stop there.
Great. We have time for one or two questions.
It's some kind of comment on these cases which you mentioned about where NC, latch NC doesn't grow.
Yeah.
Particular latch mass of eta prime and delta equal 1/2 rule. Oh, okay, I'm probably repeating myself many times, but it was kind of collection of different arguments based on some exact low energy theorem and instant calculation and others, which shows that there is a kind of higher scale in QCD, particularly associated with the global channel 0 minus and, say, quark channel 0 minus as well. So, like, G dual, I mean, in terms of gluon or Q bar gamma 5 Q for quark. Yeah. And one existence of the large scale gives a natural explanation of large eta pi mass, because it is the one which could mix with this channel. So you have one on C in the mass, but it's multiplied by the higher scale.
As no, I think it's fine. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with that. I think evidence that
I'm just trying to remind that this could be explained. But in case of delta I 1/2, it's also this, it's less this next scale, but still high scale, and which could be associated with metric element or so-called penguin operators, and it gives you, again, enhancement, which could be sufficient to explain delta I 1/2 enhancement. And when you mentioned this logarithmic running, I would certainly disagree that logarithm would produce 400 for you.
But you got to talk to Bill about this.
No, it's because it's essentially the argument of Bardeen and collaborators could be interpreted as some particular way of calculation of effective operators of penguin type. So I do not think it's a contradiction here. But what is important is a high scale enters into the play to explain, this dramatical change.
Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing. I just wanted to point out that because n is only 3, sometimes 1 over n corrections can be as big as the leading term. And in Carl put
it sharper, because proton mass or nuclear mass scales like hair.
Yeah.
Right? And eta prime is 1 over n.
So in the ratio, you will have n cube or n squared, and it's 1. Experiment.
No, it's a little dangerous to compare different kinds of quantities, because you don't know what the coefficient in front is. But I'll give you one example. In chiral perturbation theory, which is an expansion in 1/3, there's some coefficient which happens to be 10. But because it's chiral perturbation theory, there are several different processes where that same coefficient comes in. And so you take one process, you extract its coefficient, you know it's 10. But then there's a whole bunch of other things you can predict where that same value comes in. So it's not like the expansion breaks down. Once in a while, you get a number. It just, it's an order one coefficient, which sometimes can be 2 or 3 or whatever. It's not excluded.
Quick comment and then a question. The question might be left for the discussion session. It might be useful to talk not only to the string theories, but also to the lattice guys, because if you have a setup like this, and you decide that you take it seriously, Skern term plus other terms, you truncate somewhere, then you do calculations. You are implicitly assuming that your cutoff is far away. Otherwise, why would you be trying to do any calculation? If the cutoff is far away, then you take this Lagrangian and try to treat it as an effective Lagrangian with a cutoff and get the spectrum and compare with whatever you get from the loop expansion. If they don't agree, it's a headache. It's something to consider seriously. And then the question would be, anything could be said about the glue ball spectrum in large N?
I haven't looked at the glue balls. But one thing which can be said, which I didn't mention here, is some of these baryon mass relations we were able to derive with using just 1 over N without any assumption in the strange quark mass. And people doing lattice calculations typically have heavy values of MS. And they're trying to extrapolate down to light values of MS. So our mass relations hold, even if MS is large. And so that has been checked, so those work.
I mean lattice calculations where you actually take the effective Lagrangian and try to solve it, because clearly there are issues there too.
Well, I think the place where that's been done is this Kalin Klebanov, they had a Skirm crystal approach to nuclear matter, where in this effective Lagrangian you have a bunch of skirmions for the nucleons, and then they get their spins locked in some way and you get a crystal of skirmions. And that was simulated. I think you just put this chiral Lagrangian and put a constraint that the baryon number is large, or you have a finite baryon density, and people looked at that. I think that's the only case I know where people have looked at it numerically.
Okay, and we should probably leave further questions for the discussion session, so let's thank the speaker again.